All right, greetings, you happily miserable accursed. David Hurley here with the whole entire unexpurgated goddamn political panel. Jordan Leichnitz, Corey Tonight, and Scott Reed. Let's get right to it. An embarrassment of political riches this week. Doug Ford's apology and reversal on the Green Belt. Alberta coming for half of the CPP and pursuing their own provincial pension plan. Our cursed clipping today comes to us from the Winnipeg Free Press about the Manitoba election. And after all that, Gordon Pinsett will put a break to the show with our Hey Yous. Scott, Corey, Jordan, you guys all good this week?
I'm great. Just got back from a weekend up in Jenny Byrne country for one of my people I work with, Christine Simonson. She got married. Her and her husband, Steve, very happy occasion. It was nice. It's sort of a last hurrah being by a lake at the end of the year. It was really, really good.
Yeah, the last hurrah shit. Yeah,
I'm off. I'm just going to tell you right now, just a little pre-warning. I'm off. I did TV this morning. It was bad. It was like season 9 of ER with like that Croatian guy bad. Like just kind of like not interesting.
You've been bad all weekend. I saw your question period too. What's wrong? What's up with you?
I was very focused. The kids won baseball this weekend, so I was very focused on baseball.
You know, you were coaching championship baseball.
We coached a championship. Yeah, it's a house league, but hey, if it's worth winning, if it's worth playing, it's worth winning. So it was fun. So U10 North Toronto champions, you go.
Right. Well, take your victories where you can get them, eh?
That's right. About the speed of it, you know.
All right, Jordan, brag about your kid for a minute.
Oh, well, so we had, it's a big weekend in our house because my kiddos have their birthdays 2 days apart. So I now have a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old, and we've had a lot of fun. It's always like a really excellent
weekend. Do you let both dads come over at the same time, or do you break that up? Just a little joke. I told you I was off. Christ.
Woo. Well, we're awake now, huh?
Not everyone's family's like yours, Scott. Come on.
All right.
I think he's just jealous.
Joking is over.
He's just jealous at our efficiency. That's all.
Scott, you have to learn to accommodate different types of families.
That's right. That's right. It's good for you to stretch yourself a little, Scott, you know?
Oh, shit. Okay. Green belt. The inevitable came to pass after many body blows were taken, after many political bodies were buried, and after one terrific massage, the land is being put back into the green belt. Jordan, is this the end of the green belt story or the middle?
Oh, I think this is the middle, friends. And I think we should also take a moment to acknowledge that the majority of this pod called the inevitable several weeks ago. So, of course, our record isn't perfect, but it's always nice to see it validated in sometimes the most delicious way. I would say what has really struck me in all of the things that happened over the last week, of which there are many, and I think it's worth pulling apart some of the contradicting stories that have come out of the Ford government, is that ultimately what we've got here is a situation where there is some bad shit that went down and people thought that they weren't going to get caught. And then it sort of dripped out. And so this is an attempt to stop the bleeding. But my main thought is that there are likely more stories like the Las Vegas story. And there are likely more instances where you can clearly see developers having far more access than they ought to on these files, and where not only was best practice, but the law not followed in every instance. So I think this is the middle of the story, because I think Ford pulled the plug smartly. I think that was unquestionably the right thing to do at this point, in the hopes of forestalling more things coming out. But there's a big body count already for this within the Ford government. And I would not be surprised if there's more to fall still.
Well, Corey, I mean, it did seem inevitable it would end up here. Frankly, I'm sure you knew that as well. So do you think this has allowed the government to move on?
Well, first of all, I haven't even followed this story at all. What happened again?
You've been buying new jackets in Italy, by the looks of it.
Look, I think it's inevitable. I think there were, I'm always interested in the art of the apology and you know, what is it that people are looking for from you, and when do you really get in trouble on something versus you know, something where you're in trouble but not in as grave a trouble. And I think this was kind of a perfect storm of things that you know, make you be in more trouble. Like, I think it was very off-brand for Ford from the beginning. You know, if you're going to run as he did, as we did in 2018 on For the People, if it looks like you're for somebody other than the people, then that's you know, that's going to be something that's going to bite more. In addition to that, I think if you, in that same election campaign, promise you're never going to touch the greenbelt, you better till the ground really well before making that change, if you don't want to get whacked by people who voted for you. So it's you know, I think you're breaking a promise which people don't like, and you're breaking it for the, you know, for somebody other than me. And you know, I can imagine an alternative universe where if the premier had come out, you know, 6 months before making those changes and said, look, we're in a housing crisis and we got to look at everything. We got to put everything on the table, including the greenbelt. You would have had a big debate going on. You would have, you know, I think, had laid out very clearly some different processes, some which would be good and some which would be bad. And you would have a different kind of conversation around all of this, which would give you some permission with your voters to make the change. I don't think any of that permission granting happened, and as a result, I got whacked. And you know, lift the curtain a little bit. You know, some of the polling that I've seen around this issue, you know, the government's lost about 6 points in the polls. What's interesting is a lot of it is from people who actually agree with developing the greenbelt. So, you know, what does that say to you? It's not about the decision itself. It's about a loss of trust around motive and around having broken a major campaign commitment. So, you know, I think the only way to get back to where you need to be is to apologize. But in making an apology, it has to be fulsome and it has to speak to what the actual perceived offense is. And I believe the perceived offense for a lot of people who have, you know, parked their support and undecided for this government is around the promise breaking and is around the motive stuff. And if you don't recapture motive and you don't, you know, fully swallow yourself whole and go through the sort of humiliating, you know, description of what the offense was, it doesn't land. So, you know, time will tell. We'll know over the next number of weeks, you know, as additional polls come out, whether or not this thing landed or not. I think there's some reason to be hopeful about that, but, you know, let's see where it goes.
Scott, you know, you've seen a lot of these issues and come and go. And, you know, I mean, the question is that, and I put this to Marit Stiles, by the way, that person has some game, I would suggest. Anyway, she seemed to think that she was going to be able to ride this ticket right through to 2026. What do you think the lingering impact of this might be on an election that's, you know, fully 3 years from now?
Well, I really do think that remains to be seen. And here's what I think it will hinge on. I do want to just say $8.2 billion Manny Petty. I don't think I've seen that before. It's just, it's kind of untoppable. Although I'm sure the Ford government's going to give
it. It was topless?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, it was.
I was going to say, I'm sure we're not going to get into political massage stories. We don't need to do that today.
Scott, you've seen a lot of political massages over your years.
Where does this one rank?
How does that? I mean,
hard to know unless you're on the receiving end, boy.
Well, or the giving. But I think a couple things. I think the danger for the, like, so first of all, Ford does apologies well. Like, to Corey's point, you know, Ford, and I heard some people, I heard Marit, and I agree with you. I like the conversation with Marit. I think she's likable. It's a brutal job trying to punch through when you're an opposition leader in Ontario. And I would say to Liberals in particular, Ontario Liberals, watch out. Don't, you know, she's got to drag those three heavy blocks behind her, NDP, but she is capable. And I heard her talk about how she can, you know, pull this out. But I think with respect, if it's about the Greenbelt and if it's about Ford's apology, then that's going to be tougher. There are hanging threads. There are ongoing investigations. They have the potential to do harm. But if I was in the opposition, and to your question, David, I would be looking forward, not backward. I'd be looking to add elements rather than explore existing elements, because I think media and other processes will explore those existing elements for you. I think what really matters and what would make this stick is if you're able to demonstrate that the get it done culture that I would argue is at the center of what occurred here, right? When you're talking about guys going for mani-pedis, when you're talking about taking envelopes with cut and paste instructions that then guided what the policy was to chiefs of staff, when you're talking about, you know, premier's daughter's, you know, stag and doe or whatever it is, all that kind of stuff. Like, the question is, was this just isolated to the Greenbelt? Or, since we know, and the Toronto Star, you know, reminded us this weekend with its Sunday report, that the government was also handing MZOs out like hot scones at 7 a.m. Like, did we find that it's just get it done, move quickly, cut corners, process be damned, don't give a shit? Did it pervade a bunch of other stuff? And so if I was the opposition, I would look for further evidence that the real culprit here is the culture that was enabled by Ford, notwithstanding his apology, and therefore exceeds far beyond the limit of the Greenbelt policy, and whether it goes in or out of the Greenbelt lands, but that there's a whole culture of just fucking give developers and other private interests that come a-knocking whatever they want. And we'll sort it out later. We'll worry about the details later. We'll sweat it out. We'll battle the gatekeepers somehow else. But just give them what they want, and then that be damned. And then there's a bunch of middlemen who are trying to profit off of that, slime balls and Mr. X's, and they're wired into the government. And if you can demonstrate, if I'd start going really, I'd go forward, not backward. I'd go away from the Greenbelt toward other policy issues to demonstrate this is just one of a piece. And two, I'd go specific. I'd pick a couple of MZOs. Now's the time for your op research guys to earn their money. So pick a couple of MZOs, go really specific, really drill down, and put the government's ass over a flame and go, what about this parcel of land? What about this person? What about this staff? Or what about this unregistered lobbyist? Hammer, hammer, hammer in a really specific way, because those stories are understandable. And then that cracks open the notion that this is far more pervasive than the policy around the Greenbelt, which, as Corey keeps arguing, I think wisely, was not what was at the heart of this. Some people hate the idea of breaking open the Greenbelt, but the government would love to have that policy
debate. Not as many people as hated their process.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well,
right. I'd say this is a cloud of culture, and you want to create that. If you can do that, then this thing can last. If not, then it'll be another apology that Doug Ford was able to walk away from. Just like he said, I'm sorry about Rod Phillips. Golly, I'm sorry about, you know, Parks during COVID. He'll walk away from it.
Yeah, like I think that's what's really key about what you just said and what you guys were pushing on is, while, you know, these sorts of development issues, you know, whether it's Greenbelt or other things, you know, whether it's cutting down six trees at the corner of University and Queen Street, whatever, the pushback against it comes from people who haven't voted for Ford and are never going to vote for Ford. And so it's not around the issue per se. But if there's one thing that I would say is a differentiator between the Conservatives electorate and their core base and the Liberals electorate and core base, is the tolerance for an appearance of corruption is much higher amongst Liberal voters than it is amongst Conservatives. And I think that's been demonstrated over time.
Practice makes perfect.
Wasn't my experience. Maybe I just wasn't good enough at it.
I think you just hit the limit of it, David. Yeah. Just testing that ceiling, you know?
We caught the wrong elevator, David.
It's not a complete immunity to the poison, but it's a much higher tolerance for it. You know, this is like the Princess Bride sort of scenario here. We're taking a little bit all the time over a long enough period of time gives you a higher level of immunity. Well, I think there's, you know, less tolerance for that kind of bullshit from conservative voters. They don't like it. They don't want to have, you know, they don't want to be associated with that. They are very disappointed in conservative politicians who appear to be, doing things that make them question their ethics or anything around that. So I think the toxin is much more deadly for conservatives amongst their base. And I think you saw some of that through this.
So a few weeks ago, I was on here talking about our presenting sponsor TELUS's efforts to respond to specific extreme weather events and wildfires this summer. These were post-disaster relief efforts, critical in getting communities back up on their feet. But there's a whole disaster investment element to this as well, Hurley Burleyites. Seems surreal for any company or government's budget to have a significant line item called disaster funding, but here we are. We know that climate change brings extreme weather events and natural disasters. That, in turn, makes it necessary for our telecommunications industry to invest massively in their network infrastructure, so service is as close to uninterrupted as possible. The objective is always no downtime. But extreme weather puts that objective through an extreme test. Let's face it, you can't effectively fight a wildfire without a network, eh? First responders, community members, governments, and emergency services, they all need to be connected to coordinate a safe and successful operation. Back to the dollars and cents of it all. So many of these facilities and disaster sites are remote. Think, in the middle of forests and heavy brush. So when local power is compromised, generators and fuel often need to be helicoptered in to keep cell towers operational. TELUS, for their part, has worked hard to fortify operations by being proactive about it, adding generators and solar panels to its cell tower sites, proactively brush clearing to prevent fire damage, building in resilient infrastructure and redundancy at every level. I hardly have to tell you, it ain't cheap to build and maintain these networks. And then, even with all the pre-planning, sometimes disaster strikes and the investment takes a major hit. Capital is needed to rebuild in those cases too. But TELUS wants you to know the objective is still the objective. No interruptions, no downtime. They'll continue to work in partnership with local municipalities and provincial governments to make sure this critical infrastructure is ready when everybody needs it most. Let me just stick with you for a second, Corey, because I want to leapfrog off something you said earlier, which is the fact that not everybody disagreed with the Greenbelt policy. The Greenbelt policy was the symbol of the Ford government's action on housing. It was the put it in the window, here's how committed we are to housing. What replaces that? Like, what is the housing policy now?
Well, I think you got to demonstrate, building elsewhere. Like, I would say it accidentally became that. I don't think it was ever that. I find one day of the last campaign where Ford went out and said, we're going to develop the Greenbelt. The problem is that he didn't say that.
Well, that's
had
kind
he
of the
said
problem.
That, had he said that, I think that would have been good. No, it was a rabbit pulled from a hat. And that never goes over well. Like, I just, you can't swallow yourself whole on a major policy without tilling the soil pretty thoroughly first.
Or you're going to get it. Ford continues to pull rabbits out of the hat. And I just want to build on what Scott was saying, because I think he's absolutely right in terms of where the juice is on this politically. And the STARS expose on the MZOs is a really good start, but there are for sure more things there if the NDP or other parties were to dig. But the next rabbit that was pulled out of the hat is Ontario Place. And I think Ford is...
Oh, how is that a rabbit out of the hat? Like,
Hold on, Corey. Okay. You can dig yourself in a minute. But listen, this is another example where you have a seemingly snap decision that was not teed up in the public that is perceived as being for the benefit of private investors. So once again, I think that this government, and I think Ford is, there is no question, he's a very skilled politician who connects with voters on a personal level, and voters generally do have a high degree of trust in him. But where he runs into trouble is when he overreaches. It's these moments of overreach, and when it's paired with something that goes to motivation, and that motivation points to private interests pocketing shit tons of money, this is where he's in trouble. And we see this with the MZO permits. We see this with the Greenbelt. And I think that there's a lot of potential that we're going to see this with Ontario Place. So there's really, I think, only so many times where Ford can come out and apologize for what is the same foundational sin before voters start to take this as a more permanent feature of his character. So if I were an opposition party, that's certainly where I would be looking and building towards and really pulling out these examples and illustrating them. And then connecting it, by the way, again, to the shitty living conditions and the affordability crisis that middle-class Ontarians are going through right now. This is a government that's spending its time and paying attention to lining the pockets of its buddies instead of what you're going through.
Well, yeah, I don't know that Ontario Place is going to rise to the same level.
Yes, we'll find out.
Well, they've been talking about it. Like, the Fords have been talking about it forever. I remember being a political staffer in the dying days of the Harris government, and this being one of my files. Like, Ontario Place has been what it's been close since, like, 2012 completely or something. Like, this issue's been going on for decades. The Fords have been talking about developing Ontario Place since long before Doug was in politics. So, you know, I don't think that's the same at all. He's been saying he's going to do this. It's been a major plank in both election campaigns. So, you know, I think where there's a sweet spot for getting it done, it's doing the things that you said you would do, right? Like, and I think the comparison I would use is the 95 to 99 period for Premier Harris, where you're doing a lot of controversial things.
He did what he said he would do.
Yeah, you did what you said you'd do. Now, where you get yourself, I think, in a bad spot is when you start doing things you said you wouldn't do. And that's where I think the crime is. That's where I think the course correction needs to happen. I think that, you know, Ford must show significant progress on all the major planks. And one of those, by the way, is Ontario Place. Before the next election, if you want to say, I'm going to run and get it done, and I'm going to get these very specific things underway, you know, people better, you know, drive around the province and see that you've made significant headway on them, or you're going to be in a difficult position when it comes time for re-election. But, you know, you can get yourself, you know, in a lot of trouble if you add to that list some things that you explicitly said I won't do.
I think that's only half of it, though. I really strongly think that's only half the equation. So, yes, if you suddenly do things that you promised you wouldn't, then you can get into trouble. Even if you do things that you said you would do, well, he did what he said he was going to do, right? That's to the good, except for there's always the extra screen of for whom was it done? And if it is demonstrable that things are being done not for the benefit of people, not with some degree of appropriate process, even if you bash the process down and speed it up and all that sort of stuff, but that it ends up lining the pockets of folks. And in particular, I go back to it. These kind of guys, these sort of shady characters that leech off of the middle of the transaction, like take MZOs. I believe absolutely that the government has handed out squillions of the MZOs. I don't actually believe that it's actually using it as some sort of mechanism to lever party donations. I think that it's just, that's the view. Fucking do it. Let's hand them out to everybody. But there are people who smell that out and then advertise themselves as being uniquely qualified and super wired in that they can deliver MZOs. And those guys are arbitraging off of that.
Well,
and if those people are wired in, there's trouble there. I would get one of those MZOs.
Wait, I'm going to close it. Inserting themselves in the middle of this process and the government's going to wear it.
Okay. I'm going to say this. Unless there's a scandal involved in it, not a single riding in Ontario will change over the Ontario Place.
Right.
Well, over their plans,
I agree. That's my second test.
It's not Toronto Place. It's not Canada Place. It's Ontario Place. And, you know, and when you push voters in terms of... Well, it means
it's not Manitoba Place. It's not Minnesota Place.
It's developing an Ontario provincial property. That's what it is. It's not, you know, this is, you know,
Fucking guys have wanted to pave it over and turn it into a goddamn casino.
All right. Scott's been having a supporter. Corey's been having a bad enough time. I'm going to get myself in trouble.
All right.
I'm going to get myself in trouble because I'm going to zag here.
Ooh.
And I'm going to say that the other person for whom this Greenbelt story has been unhelpful, I think, is Bonnie Crombie. Yeah. I do not think Bonnie Crombie needed this story. And I think there are liberals who suspect that her own ties with developers or her own past with Mississauga will prevent her from fully exploiting this issue, perhaps even make her vulnerable on this issue. And I think liberals see this as something on which you've got to be four square. I'm not saying she can't fight her way out of it, and I'm not saying she's not going to win. I think she is the front runner, but I think this has been an uncomfortable issue for her, and I think it is not a great thing to be kicking around while people are thinking about who they're going to vote for on this question. Scott, what do you think?
I agree with that, but I would actually say in a weird way, Ford's apology was a bit of a relief for her, I think. Because you could try to backburner the specific issue of the Greenbelt. I think that helps. And in a weird way, if this controversy continues, if, for example, I am correct, and say the NDP or the Toronto Star is able to mine MZOs and can sustain this notion that there's a culture of hand it out, give them up, and reward some people, not others, I think that will continue to put her on the spot where she'll have to figure out whether she's fish or fowl. And I assume in particular, if she wins this thing at the end of November, or end of the fall, I should say, then, she's going to have to kind of come out with her fists up one way or the other. So in a weird way, she kind of maybe wants this thing to pass because it takes the focus off it.
100%. Yeah. Jordan, do you have any thoughts about that?
I just think the appearance of, this is messy for her. There's no question. But more than anything, too, the appearance of sort of hesitation and weakness on it is not good. And I think that there's certainly the scent of blood in the water on it around her, and she needs to get a hold of it quickly. They have to decide which way they want to go. And they evidently haven't. It looks painful to watch.
Well, I'm not sure she can distance herself from that because, she's been mayor for a long time and she's had all kinds of transactions go through City Hall under her watch. And because nobody reports on municipal politics, there's been no scrutiny of any of those. And where there's no scrutiny and there's no light, that's often where, you find the cockroaches scurrying around. So, she'll go through a very thorough OPPO vetting. And, and if it's done by the Conservatives, it'll be after she's elected, in the sense that sometimes having somebody with those problems in that seat isn't so bad for you.
Next week, you may have heard, is National Truth and Reconciliation Day in Canada. You'll be hearing a lot in the days ahead about the state of Canada's relationship with Indigenous people and the many goals that remain. You'll also see a lot of orange shirts. You might even want to wear one yourself on September 30th. It's an opportunity to reflect on our history and the tragic legacy of government and church-run residential schools that shattered so many Indigenous homes. It's also an opportunity to reflect on how we build a better future. Our sponsor, CN, has committed to undertake that journey. For the largest railway in Canada, it is a significant commitment. Its railway runs through or in proximity of nearly 220 reserve lands of nearly 130 First Nation and Métis territories in 8 provinces. CN recognizes the importance of ensuring its trains operate safely and sustainably, as well as the mutual benefits of partnering with Indigenous communities along its network. In addition to an employee resource group, ERG, that offers a safe space for Indigenous and non-Indigenous employees to share, learn, and grow together around the unique recognitions, relationships, and histories that Indigenous peoples hold, CN has a strong, diverse Indigenous relations team that engages and builds relationships with Indigenous communities every day. The Indigenous Relations Team and the Indigenous ERG participate in events, hold discussions, and support Indigenous-led programs related to education, employment, procurement, and cultural learning. In other words, CN is trying hard to do its part. It's all any of us can do. We have a clipping this week, and it's a controversial clipping. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. In provincial elections, you don't get a lot of polling. In the Manitoba election, we had a poll at the very beginning that showed the two parties surprisingly tied after years of the NDP having been in the lead. And then in the last week or so, we've had two polls come out. One that was taken over an extended period of time starting September 7th by Probe Research for the Winnipeg Free Press and CTV. And that one shows an 11-point NDP lead suddenly from a tie at the start. Seems like a big shift in an election campaign, for sure. And it showed, I think, almost a 30-point lead for the NDP in Winnipeg proper itself. There's subsequently to that an Angus Reid Institute poll that showed, a 6-point NDP lead over the Conservatives, so closer and a little bit more recent. And I think subsequent to both of those things, there's been the one provincially televised leaders debate. So let's put that all aside. But I do want to talk about a few things in this Probe survey that are unlikely to have changed, even if top-line vote intention has changed. And this is Kevin Rollison from the Winnipeg Free Press writing about this poll. The poll asked Manitoba voters what they see as the biggest issues in the 2023 election, provincial election. The top three, crime and violence in their communities, number one, 25% said that. State of the healthcare system, number two, 23% said that. And poverty, homelessness, 23% said that. First of all, that's quite a surprising, with the exception of healthcare, quite a surprising top three list of issues. Interestingly, according to the poll, on crime and public safety, the two parties, the NDP and the Conservatives, were tied, with 31% effectively saying that each of them would be best able to deal with that. The last time we talked about the Manitoba election, we talked a lot about the Conservative emphasis on crime in the campaign and how they were really going hard on crime. So it's interesting to see that the two parties are tied in their ability to do that. Other issues raised by at least 1 in 10 Manitobans were the rising cost of living, 14%, drugs and addiction issues, 12%, and housing, 11%. Tied with two other issues in 10th place at only 4% is the Tories' other big platform plank, taxation. So, tough situation on that data set, Corey, for the PCs. On one of their two main planks, they have no advantage, and the other is not that important to voters. How did they end up here?
Well, I think it's framing of the election issues. I guess we'll see. I wouldn't be completely alarmed by those numbers and those issue advantages because in almost every campaign I've ever been involved in, healthcare has been the number one issue. And the Conservatives have had a significant deficit in terms of support or belief in that issue. But what ends up debasing that with the electorate is that nobody really believes either party or any of the parties have the tools available to them to significantly change outcomes. So
you can occasionally, by the way, Corey, just to say, you can occasionally punch through on that, as Tim Houston did in the Nova Scotia election, right?
Like the Houston example is so interesting because of it's such an outlier. Like it's such an outlier. It's the first time I'd ever seen that done. And, you know, and I find it fascinating how that is. But, you know, part of that might be what we're seeing on crime. Like if there's enough fatigue with the government that, you know, you can tighten those numbers. You know, we saw in 2018.
Can't run on your record and those things in.
What's my takeaway from all the polling is it's a lot tighter than we thought it was going to be going in. That there are, you know, certainly if you're talking about, you know, the time shift between the first poll and the second, the Angus Reid one being certainly the better known, you saw the lead close basically in half, you know, from 11 points to 6. So, you know, I think things are moving. I think there's some signs that this is going to be a complicated election. I don't think anyone is pulling away with a moment of you are, you know, for sure the person that we want to see leading the province. So how does that play out? I could see it going a number of different ways. I could see voter turnout being surprisingly low and still seeing the government change. I could see the voter turnout being surprisingly low and the Conservatives you know, squeaking through. The number that was the same in both the polls, though, that I think might be the biggest factor is the fact that the Liberals are below 10. And there, I believe it's like 11 or 14 ridings, something like that, that they don't have a candidate in. And some of those are in seats where the Conservatives really need them to shave some points off the NDP in order to win. So that factor.
Yeah, the NDP are collapsing that liberal vote in Winnipeg. It's brutal.
Yeah, it would seem so, but you know, you never totally can collapse it, and in tight seats, even 3 or 4 points is going to make a big difference. And so if you don't have a liberal candidate on the ballot, like, that could prove to be a determining factor. So look, I would think there's a advantage NDP right now, but I don't think I would be folding up my tents or anything like that. If I were Stephenson, I think I would be tripling down on GOTV efforts, because I think every vote's going to really count.
Hey, Jordan, I'm interested in your take on the whole election, obviously, but I'd like to particularly focus in with you on the healthcare question. I think it's super interesting that the national media seems to think that the healthcare issue went away with the federal-provincial agreement on healthcare. But all of my polling indicates that healthcare is a raging issue out there on the ground and growing in importance year after year, frankly, month after month, as people have more and more difficulty accessing the healthcare system. What are the NDP saying in Manitoba that would be resonating with people about healthcare?
So I think what Canoe's campaign is doing right on healthcare is that the promises are incredibly specific and incredibly strategic, right? So he's talking about reopening ERs in the exact Winnipeg ridings that he needs to win. So the challenge, I think, often when talking about healthcare as an issue, and this is doubly so at the federal level where you're that much further removed from implementation, is do people believe you can have any influence on it? And do they think that the changes that you're proposing are doable, right? And so often at the federal level, and I say this, particularly for parties who are in opposition, the distance there is just too great to bridge, right? Because really you're coming down to, is it the right amount of money, and are there the correct strings attached to it? And for many Canadians, that's a pretty esoteric debate. And I think that the difference here, what Canoe's campaign is doing really well, is that they are speaking about healthcare in absolutely concrete, relatable terms that people understand. There was an ER open in their community, and the Conservatives closed it. And they are just going after it so hard and so clearly, and people can see immediately what they know what that change is going to feel like to have that resource back open. So I think they were smart in terms of what they picked. I think that they've also been extremely disciplined in how they are keeping that message at the core of their campaign. There have been a lot of opportunities for them to be pulled off of that message, but they have not. They said their piece on crime and dealing with Canoe's past. And I think that the polling that we have seen suggests to me that that was effective. And now they've taken the healthcare message and they're making an appeal and a pitch very, very directly to those Liberal voters. They know that those are the votes that they need to get in the basket. And they're out doing now, get out the vote, right? So again, like, we have like a 10-day get out the vote period. And this is definitely advantage NDP. The Manitoba NDP's ground game is phenomenal. They know these communities top to bottom, and they're going to be getting out and squeezing every single vote in advance of E-Day that they can. And so I think in general, really, there's not much I would say that Canoe's campaign could be doing in addition to what they're doing. All the right boxes are being ticked, and clearly there is something in terms of both authenticity and also competence that voters in Manitoba are responding to. And lastly, I would say, I think it seems to me like we may have seen Stephenson, they might have peaked a little bit early with the third party ads and all of the government ad spend that they did over the summer leading up. That might have actually been as good as it was going to get for them. So we'll see what the next few days have to bring. But I was struck that when they had the choice of issues to place when they bought the wrap in the Winnipeg Free Press, that it was not that they were going to be tough on crime, but that they weren't going to search the landfill. So I really think that if your message is tough on crime, unless it's against Indigenous women, that's maybe not great for you.
Just a couple quick points. One, every day that the Conservatives don't buy a wrap for the Winnipeg Free Press, it's a wrap for the NDP. I think it is the most pro-NDP, most hostile Conservative paper in the country, bar none.
Only one not owned by Post Media. That's why you feel that way.
I'm breaking out my tiny violin for you, Corey. Don't come cry to a new Democrat about biased fucking media, because you don't want to hear it.
What fucking checkbook does he have? What checkbook does he have? They fucking bled that thing dry.
So, okay, but in terms of around promises, like, I think my outsider view of what Stephenson's narrative around the NDP is that basically that these guys are not going to be competent in terms of how they make decisions, and the reasons they're going to do them are going to be sort of starry-eyed but not effective. And so, you know, why are ERs closing, not just in Manitoba but elsewhere? It's because of lack of people to work in them. And so saying, oh, we're going to open 4 more ERs when we don't have enough doctors and nurses for the ones we have.
They've got a strategy for hiring more staff.
Corey, you're saying they're promising things they might not be able to do?
By the way, I'm not sure that re-electing the government is provided over
this
the crisis.
Is the end of it.
I'm not sure voters are thinking that's a real solution either.
Hey, Scott, let me drop you into a familiar situation.
Sure.
You're in a war room, you're in an HQ, late in the campaign, and you're behind, and none of the issues are working for you. What do you do?
You've never been there before, have you?
Well, you know me, I knock off around 8:30 and find some place that serves brown fluid. I don't know. I'll come back to that in 1 second, because I don't know what the answer is. I don't believe Stephenson is going to win this campaign. I don't think that it's going well. I don't believe much of what Corey said, with the greatest of respect. I think a lot of his spin. I think this thing is bad and getting worse for them. And I think that the thing, we have so little information to work with, but I would isolate two factors. One, in none of the polling, small amounts, though there is available, none of it tells us that Wab Kanu has been disqualified during the course of the campaign, which was a critical fundamental factor, had to be achieved by
certainly
the
not true in Winnipeg.
I agree with that.
Second, the economy almost perplexingly is not a top of mind issue, affordability, those kinds of things. And that's bad news for the Conservatives. They need those issues, taxes, affordability, lowering the amount that you have to spend on stuff. And you know that healthcare in a province like Manitoba, in a circumstance like ours right now in the fall of 2023, is going to be a driving issue. But, you know, those pocketbook issues are down the scale there, and that's trouble for the Conservatives. So the thing I would say for the NDP that they have to worry about is, and despite the fact that they do have a good ground game, particularly in Winnipeg, I do think you have to worry about whether there's an election day discount. And you got to be very, very scared of that. I think whether it's quiet prejudice that cannot show up in polling against Wab Kanu as an Indigenous leader, and God, I hope that isn't the case, but I fear that there could be a little factor in there, or whether it's just the hesitation that people sometimes have around voting NDP. That's less prevalent in a place like Manitoba, certainly less prevalent in Winnipeg. But those are the only things I'd really be anxious about. I'd be trying to cruise control the rest of this week, just keep hammering away on the healthcare message. Be safe, be focused, and focus on those swing ridings that are going to put you over the top. And if I was in the war room for the Conservatives, I think I'd be swinging wildly, irresponsibly, ugly at Wab Kanu. I don't know that they have any other option. And frankly, I always thought the only chance they had of being competitive in this campaign was to win ugly. And when we're talking ugly in this circumstance, it's fucking ugly. Like it's real kind of, it's a real kind of ugly. And I doubt that Stephenson will go the full way on that.
But I think we've sort of said that. I don't really disagree with anything you said, Scott. What I would say is I think that we don't have enough polling information to really, be highly predictive around this. Like these are small polls with large margins of error and taken quite a while ago with major events that have happened in between the polls and now. So I say, this is a lot of guesswork on our part, but I would agree that, the denormalization of your opponent when you're seeking a third term, I think it's essential. I think it's the same factor that you're going to have in the next federal election campaign. If Trudeau isn't able to either find an issue that is much bigger than anything else, I think we might talk about that. Canada Pension Plan is certainly one that holds some potential around that. You got to denormalize your opponent. And
who understood this first was Lee Atwater. Lee Atwater running George W. Bush, not George W., George Bush's campaign against Michael Dukakis in 1988, going for a third going through a third straight term. The alternative cannot be acceptable. That is the bottom line. I think there's something in here, and I'm just going to leave on this. I get to end this segment. I think that for the two parties that are really competing in the urban cores of the cities, there's a real lesson from this data set in Winnipeg of what's important to people and what isn't. When you look at these things, crime and violence, poverty, homelessness, drugs and addiction issues, housing, people are really concerned about their cities. People who are living in cities are really concerned about their state of life in their cities. And that's going to be on the ballot federally.
And provincially in a number of other provinces. Like I think this is a big issue. It's going to be a big issue in BC in their provincial election. I think it's ground zero and maybe the point of origin for a lot of the policies around how to deal with addiction and homelessness. And for all of the experts who come out and say that the BC approach, the Vancouver approach is the science-based approach, then it's the only one that can possibly work. I think the question is going to be asked, how come things are getting so much worse around this? And I thought actually the curse of politics with Kennedy that you did, or sorry, not curse, the hurly-burly that you did with him was extremely revealing. It was basically, at the end, you asked him the $64,000 question. So given that, you basically got to run the table on policy changes in this one direction, how come things are getting worse? And he basically, shrugged his shoulders and threw up his hands and said, well, I don't know. I guess maybe I have to look at other things too. That is a damning indictment in my view.
Well, I'm not sure I'd take Kennedy as the entire test case for the theory.
Well, it is the test market for all of these approaches that we've seen that have rolled across the country. And look, the zombie apocalypse is getting worse in the downtown of every city in this country right now.
Okay. All right, let's move west. Let's keep moving west from Manitoba until we find the raccoons, because the raccoons are back.
Did they ever really leave?
Premier Smith of Alberta has reverted back to her pre-election incarnation and is promising to pull Alberta out of the Canada Pension Plan and take half of the assets with her. This is not going to happen, so I refuse to debate the policy merits of this idea. But Scott,
can we just have a moment to just consider how absolutely batshit insane all of it is? Just for a moment.
It's not going to happen. What is her agenda in proposing it?
I don't foreclose the possibility that she thinks that she'd like to pursue this. But probably as you scamper the raccoons out, probably the rational thought, I guess, is that she's trying to move through the list of all the insane things to which she committed to her base prior to entering politics or upon entering politics. She's got this Rob Anderson guy in her office who's absolutely determined that they should, do the whole, Alberta stand. It's going to be its own country and all this kind of stuff. And
Private Bannon or something. Eh?
I just think she's, I assume that, I don't want to make assumptions, but I mean, if you're looking for an answer to your question, a logic to it would be, all right, we'll put this thing out there. We'll try to play to bleachers to say, see, we're owed half of the whole fund. We've been getting fucked, people. Like, this is just another example of how they jam it to us. Now I'll do consultations. She'll find out that even half of her own voters are like, who are, skew older, are going like, don't fuck with my pension. And maybe you're not super duper stable. Maybe the last set of safe hands that I want holding my pension. So just leave it alone. And then she can sort of say, well, I gave it the old college try and it looks like it's not. At this point, this issue is not mature enough. And so a la prochaine. She's unpredictable and you don't know. And you don't know how this, I know this. I know the politics of this are absolutely juicy for the prime minister. This is a very rare opportunity for him to align himself with a whole wide variety
Nobody hates this issue more than Pierre Poilievre.
Last week was goddamn busy, right? You had Zelensky and everything else going on. Then the green ballot issue hit the same day that she released the transfer amount and all this sort of stuff. But if I was the prime minister returning to Ottawa this week and saying, all right, what's on the agenda? I would wrap myself in the Canada Pension Plan and I would just start swinging. And I just think that's a debate that if I were him, I'd love to have over and over and over again because it aligns him with a much larger share of voters than he currently lays claim to.
Especially in Alberta. A guy who's got 15% support in Alberta has an issue in which he's got 70% of the people on his side or more.
Like two-thirds of Albertans think this is a shit idea. So, you know, the vote divide on that is excellent for anyone.
80%! 80% of the 53% of the fund that she says they're owed comes as a consequence of investment decisions made by an independent, professionally managed CPP, which, by the way, little commercial for the past, we, David, had a role Paul set up, right? When he professionalized the CPPIB and created the investment board and allowed us to say, well, let's grow this, which is now a model that's copied by, you know, jurisdictions around the world. And she's saying, I want to pull out of that thing that generated all that income, but I want the fruits of that labor. It's just bananas.
Even Saskatchewan's going to have to break with her on this because it would be terrible for Saskatchewan. It would be terrible for Saskatchewan. There.
Yeah, it's... Yeah, well, I mean, this is a stupidity. Everybody has a stake, right?
Well, yeah, it actually affects a lot of people's lives. But I don't understand why she's doing this. Like, I think how she got elected, and I credit... obviously her, she's ultimately the decision maker. So her first and foremost, but you know, I'll also give a big shout out to Steve Outhouse. And like when her campaign manager came out there, they repositioned, they got off the Sovereignty Act, which was like the only fight that you could have with the federal government. It's the second least popular. Like, this is the least popular. The second least popular was the Sovereignty Act. And then there's 43 other things that you could fight with the federal government about where you get a supermajority of support for in the province of Alberta. So I don't understand why you take the least popular ones. But I think what, you know, Steve, and what ultimately Premier Smith did was decide to put that on the shelf and fight on the other things. And then as a result, she won the campaign. But this is a regression in that it's going back to something that is very unpopular. It's going to create friction with her and Poilievre. I agree with that. This is the worst issue. If Daniel Smith wanted to help Pierre Poilievre become Prime Minister of Canada, and he had to come up with a list of things I don't want you to ever touch or do, this would probably be number one. And I think she's doing no favors for the federal party by pushing this forward. I can't think that anybody's smiling in the Poilievre campaign team that she's insisting on doing this. And there's other people who'd be, you know, positively predisposed to support her on a whole range of other issues, in Atlantic Canada. But they can't support her on this. Like, this is from a policy standpoint. I'll just say one other thing.
If I was Poilievre, I'd run, not walk, to a microphone on Monday. Like, we're recording this Monday morning. If I was Poilievre, I wouldn't allow this. Like, what is the interest that he has
align
to balance?
Align himself with the 80% of Albertans. And
run to the microphone and say, you know what? Look, I'm not going to trash the idea. She's going to do a consultation. That's fine. But I'm telling you right now, I'm opposed to it. And as a potential prime minister, it's not something I would do.
We can't talk about this. And you like using the raccoon language. Well, the raccoon in this case came from Toronto. And it's Morneau Chappelle. Did this? It's the least effective and impactful finance minister in the history of Canada. That actually, you know, his company's got their signature at the bottom of it. So
I would not be very happy with my
former finance minister for his participation in this charade.
Any number of reasons.
Jordan, if I was Rachel Notley, I would be just in the basement drinking. just embittered at the fucking world. I would just be like, this is such fucking bullshit that people believed her that she wouldn't fucking do this.
I mean, I hate to say it, people, but voting fucking matters. And here's your proof. Alberta, you could have had so much better. So just know that everyone around the country is judging you right now. I mean, listen, I'm going to say charitably that I think maybe the reason she's doing this is she wants to pick that fight with Trudeau. That's the only, but you're, you know, as
why this Corey, fight?
There's so many other fights that are much cleaner politically. So then that leads me to the raccoons are not just in her head, but they're in her office and they're driving the bus. And this is a really big problem. And really, I think it suggests that this is the beginning, not the end, of bad political calculus that's driven by ideology that we just had a whole election that was a test case that it didn't resonate with voters. So they've got a huge problem there if that's actually what is driving this decision making, as it seems to be. And last thing I'll say, and you know, David and I were chatting about this over the weekend, is that this is so dangerous for her because it does go to her character. She lied.
It's a lie.
He absolutely straight out lied to Albertans.
To go to the Greenbelt, to go to the Greenbelt point.
Yeah, I was just going to say, look, I'm not going to sit on the top of a high pedestal here and wag my finger at anyone because we just did a version of same in Ontario and look where it got us. So I think, you know, it's doing things that you said you weren't going to do, as we said earlier, you know, that can come with a price that you don't like.
Yeah. But unlike Ford, who I think has demonstrated capacity to walk back from the brink on these things when it's hurting him, I don't think that she has shown that same capacity. So the long-term damage could actually be much more significant here. And if the NDP does their job, it will be.
Well, Ford is a populist and Smith is an ideologue, and there is a difference between the two. And so, you know, the climb downs for Ford come in the same way they did from Ralph Klein, if we want to use another Alberta example, which is desire to not be offside with large parts of the electorate and being really, you know, fundamentally motivated by that. So, you know, I think there is
and the best apologies are abject ones.
Right. And sincere.
Yeah.
As someone who sometimes hosts a drive radio show program on talk radio, I will just tell you that subgenre universe, as fun as it is and as much as I enjoy doing that gig, is not the real world. And if you point your political compass based on what you think you heard from people who were calling and texting in when you were a talk show radio host, you are fucking bananas. And she thinks the people that called into her radio show that listened to this bullshit that she peddled are the public. They're not the public. They're a tiny slice of the public. And well, she's going to govern for those people, and she's going to govern like those people are the entire public, and it's going to be a train wreck.
Yeah, but fuck, look at the person. Look at the woman, okay? She fucking took Jason Kenney out of the premiership. I mean, Jason Kenney, one of the most skilled politicians in the conservative movement in the last 20, 30 years, she takes him out of the premiership, and she makes herself the premier by beating Rachel Notley, one of the great talents of Alberta politics in the modern era, period. So she's fucking got something.
Yeah, she does.
Well, listen, you were on the microphone. Question.
Like, she mobilizes. She mobilizes a segment of the population who has resonance with something she says. But I do
she's
think...
She's whack.
And she's...
But she's whack.
The, you know, the ready, fire, aim is going to get her in the end. Like... The flame burns too hot there, that's for sure. And I think this is going to blow up in her face in a pretty spectacular way.
But well,
I've
spent a decade laughing at this woman ever since the blow up in the election campaign, Wild Rose, and then the crossover to... I've been laughing at her for a decade, and here she is. She's the fucking premier. So I'm going to stop laughing at her.
More political lives than a cat. Yeah.
Well, it shows there's something there, but like, I don't imagine it. Talk radio, although I haven't listened to it in Alberta, is jumping up and down with calls of support around this for some of the reasons why, you know, talk radio turned very heavily against Ford on Greenbelt. And, you know, why do I think there's some hope the apology on that's going to land? It's because talk radio turned very heavily the other way once he apologized. So I'll be interested to see what some of those sort of conservative touchstones, which I think are markets that, clearly are more impactful in the thinking of this Smith government, how this plays out, and whether or not they back away from the flame. We saw them back away on Sovereignty Act, much to her political benefit. We'll see whether they do on this, but certainly saying you're going to take 11% of the population is going to take, you know, 50-some percent of the pension fund is not something that others are going to let pass unremarked upon.
No. All right. It's time for Mr. Pinsent, unfortunately. We could have him go on for quite a while.
No, India. Today. We didn't get to India.
We didn't get to India. Throw a hey you if you got something to say about India. Maybe we'll get back to it next week. You know, I've yet in my lifetime to see a Canadian issue that was even remotely affected by an international or foreign policy matter. So, Gordon Pinsent, what's up?
Ladies and gentlemen, please return to your seats. The Hey You's are about to begin.
Okay, who's going first?
Well, I got an India-related one.
There you go. Okay. Fire it up.
So look, there's lots I'd like to say on India, but I had my Hey You marked, for Speaker Anthony Rota. But I think it's the blame goes much beyond him. You don't get in the text for a welcome to a foreign leader without some vetting, and whether it's foreign affairs, whether it's the Privy Council office, whether it's the Prime Minister's office, whether it's the Speaker's office, whether it's a combination of all of them, I think it probably is. To have the whole parliament stand up and applaud someone from the innocuously named First Ukrainian Division, which is a lot better name, apparently, than the 14th Waffen Grenadier Division or the SS Galician. Anyway, I can't pronounce it. But anyway, a Nazi SS unit, that is a major failure in vetting. That is a major failure. And it's something that's embarrassing to the government, to everyone who sits in parliament, to Canada as a whole. It's an embarrassment to our guests, the president of the Ukraine. I hope that there is some explanation as to how the fuck that happened. And I hope that somebody puts out an apology around this that is fulsome as to how the hell that happened. You know, when Himmler's out there praising this unit for their efficiency in killing Poles, I think that's, you know, sign that we shouldn't be applauding them in parliament.
Yeah. I love how the guy just rolls up to parliament assuming that he should be honored.
Yeah. Like he's yeah. Well, I have a very similar Hey You, so maybe I'll just build on Corey's. So my Hey You is on the very same fucking embarrassing issue. Holy shit, people. And it kind of goes in two directions. So my first Hey You is to the Speaker's office, who I am confident did the majority of the things that shouldn't have been done here. And I think the key words that we saw were, I recognize someone from my riding. So this to me says there's a staffer somewhere who did not do their homework. But my pro tip for you is that if somebody tells you that they fought the Russians in the 1940s, fucking Google that shit. Okay. Cause that's not good. All right. That's your first hint. But my other Hey You is to all the other staffers who might be feeling a little smug that they did not make this error. Because I will tell you that there are so many other errors out there of a similar and worse ilk even to be made. And so my Hey You is to all the staffers working on the Hill. I know your days are long. I know you get a lot of this shit across your desk. But please, you have to Google and vet these people. And we had a saying in our Oppo research team, it's in God we trust and all others we vet. All others. People from your riding, people from your party, vet them all. Don't be this person.
But Jordan, don't worry. The Speaker announced that he was taking full accountability and responsibility for it. And then the next sentence you would expect to be, and so I resigned my position. But that sentence is not there. Mm-hmm. Because in today's political world, to say that you accept full accountability and responsibility is to have done that.
Well, I think he's taking a cue from some of our other political leaders, including the Premier of Ontario, when it comes to flexibility around apologies and consequences.
Well, let's make it a hat trick, because I'm going to focus on this and I'm going to go more precise, I think. And I'll say this all with some sadness and reluctance, because I know Tony, I know Anthony Rota, and I like him, right? And I believe that you know, people need people who have been around Parliament Hill, have been around politics, have been around government, need to also recall that, you know, the Speaker rules the parliamentary precinct. And when you've got someone from the Speaker's riding, probably put therefore directly on the list by the Speaker, you know, all these calls for, well, like, obviously PCO and PMO vetted this and there's a great big scandal. I don't believe any of that. I think that people are looking past the truth of the matter, which is that the Speaker does have this kind of discretion, would exercise it in some cases for someone who's 98 years old from his riding. I believe absolutely indisputably that it was his error, and I believe that it was made in good faith. But I do think as well, and I say this with, you know, reluctance, I think he has to resign. I think Anthony Rota has to resign as Speaker, because it is appalling what occurred. And yes, I believe it was an honest mistake, but it's so appalling that I don't know what you could do to make it better. I don't know.
Just as a person, if you had been standing there and applauding for that person, how would you feel right now about having stood and applauded for that person?
It's appalling. I'm sure he feels sick, absolutely sick to death about it, but it occurred. And it probably occurred. I think it almost certainly occurred directly at his instigation. And I think you got to be accountable for it. I think that means you have to leave the post. I just do.
Yeah. No, it's you. All right. My Hey You is a little different. My Hey You goes out to the federal Liberals. Take note of what's happening in Manitoba. When you've been in office for a while, even the issues that are traditional strengths turn on you because you've been in office and problems remain in those areas. You can see that the federal Liberals don't score particularly well on things like environment or climate or reducing poverty, where they've got a record they can and should be proud of. You can't run on your record. You have to run on what you will do and, more importantly, what you say Polyev will do. Anyway, that's my Hey You. That's our show for this week. Thank the three of you. It was great. We had great fun today. I don't know if we lived up to expectations or hopes, but I had a fun time today. I'd like to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. All of you cursed who watched or listened today, and we'll be back next week with more Curse of Politics. In the meantime, take care of yourselves.